Treras and another collaborator, Pedro Espinosa Bravo, were sentenced and condemned. Previously, the agent who went to the U.S. had gone into a plea bargaining agreement. He had been tried in the U.S. He spent barely 5 years in jail or 7 years after this terrorist attempt in Washington, D.C., the first one that had occurred till then on U.S. soil, where an American citizen was also assassinated along with my father, Ronnie Carpen Moffitt. But we have been able to advance justice. There are things that are pending. And in the search of that information, there have been wonderful people, incredible people who have struggled in Chile and in the U.S. to get more truth. There's been a wonderful person working at the National Archives Project, Peter Kornbluh, people at the IPS, human rights workers, as I have said, in the U.S., who has helped us get more information. There's still some facts which are pending, and we have the confidence that truth will prevail. And we also are very satisfied, allow me to say it, that a group of congressional reps, senators, House of Representatives have forward a motion to get history straight, as there always were a group of senators and reps who accompanied the cause of democracy in Chile. What is about to be voted in these next days also is part of this administration of justice and creating or getting facts correct.
And could you talk about the challenges still facing Chile's Congress and President Boric, the importance of him participating in the event in Washington?
Look, President Boric, as he said when he was there, Sheridan Circle, was born 10 years after my father's assassination. He is the youngest president we have had in Chile. He is a man who is extremely committed to human rights in Chile and abroad. He has the conviction that no democratic society can exist without full respect of human rights, not mattering if it's a government of one political tendency or another. It can be from the right, it can be from the left, but human rights have to be always upheld. He has stayed and maintained that position internationally regarding cases like in Nicaragua or Venezuela or elsewhere. And he has also been very committed to what is happening in Chile in the tasks which are still pending. He has announced an initiative that is called in Chile Plan Nacional de Búsqueda. It's a national state guaranteed project or initiative where the government authorities and agencies have the legal obligation to aid all relatives of those who were detained and disappeared and whose bodies have still not appeared. It's more than 1,100 persons. The state has the obligation to help find closure for these families with more truth and more justice. He's a president who is extremely committed with human rights. And we as a family are in particular extremely grateful. I'm sure the Carpen Moffitt family feels the same, that he has accompanied us, or he would have accompanied us last Saturday in an incredible and very emotive activity on Sheridan Circle.
You were referencing the apology resolution and in the United States Congress. Talk more about what that resolution, if passed, the one that Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others is supporting, what would that mean? And how did what happened 50 years ago and 47 years ago in the case of the assassination of your father shape Chile today? Juan Pablo Letelier.
Let me state the following. Church report, the congressional church report, which was worked through with a number of senators in the U.S. Congress after the military coup in Chile, got part of the facts straight. It stated clearly that there was covert action by the Nixon government against Allende's government, first trying to destabilize the government economically, then politically, financing opposition, financing illegal and terrorist acts in Chile. That information is what gave us the conviction that the overthrow of the Allende government probably would not have occurred had it not been for U.S. covert intervention. Now, that is something which still is a wound in Chile. It is obvious that there was a political conflict in Chile at the time. But what created the conditions for the breaking of democracy was this covert action. In the following years, there were many brave members of Congress who accompanied the Chileans who fought for democracy. Senator Tom Harkin was one of them. Kennedy and many others accompanied us. George Miller, and many other House of Representatives. But this resolution, which is being put forth today, has an additional value. And I think it's very important to underline its importance, because it will say, if approved, that Congress as a body recognizes, one, that the use of covert actions is unacceptable, that the use of violence is unacceptable as a mechanism of resolution of conflict of any type. And it states that there's a conviction, a profound regret of what has happened. It is a way of recognizing U.S.'s responsibility in what happened in Chile, also in other countries. But in the case of Chile, it's very important because what occurred is that the Allende government came to power through a democratic process, a fully democratic process. Chile was one of the most stable democracies in Latin America till 1973. We have recovered our democracy. We're working on it day to day. But to have this statement by National Congress, I think, not only helps to get history straight, it's a recognition of many people, many movements, many actors in the U.S. who do not accept the use of violence internally or externally to resolve conflicts. I think it's an incredible importance, not only for Chile, but I think it's also important for internal U.S. policy, the way we have to, as humanity, as mankind, and within each of our countries, how we have to get things done.
And could you tell us in a brief few seconds that we have left for this segment, there was a national search plan approved recently by the Chilean government to search for people who disappeared, who were disappeared during the Pinochet dictatorship. What remains to be done in this area?
I think the importance of President Boric's initiative is twofold. Firstly, this is not a responsibility of relatives alone. It can't be that those who are victims are the only ones responsible for looking for their relatives, searching for their relatives, getting information regarding what happened to the relatives, which in the great majority were persons under 30 years of age. The first importance of Boric's announcement is that this will be a state agency responsibility to search, to find, to discover what happened beyond the judicial branch. Secondly, it's a way of recognizing that there's a state responsibility in what occurred. They were state agents of the state, persons who work for the government, a dictatorship by all means, but for the state at that point. And hence, the state will accompany the families, the relatives, till they get justice done. And trying to find out what happened. Now, we have some versions in Chile of what has happened to some of those bodies, to some of those persons. It's horrific. Some were thrown to the oceans with railroad rails tied to their bodies. There are other versions of some of the corpses or bodies that were unburied at one point, put together and bombed literally the bones to shreds. There are many versions of this tape. That is what has to be set as an official and judicial reality, a story version, so that the families can find closure regarding what happened to their relatives.
Juan Pablo Letelier, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Former member of the Chilean House and Senate for 32 years, was in high school when his father, Orlando Letelier, was assassinated with U.S. activist Ronnie Moffitt in a car bombing September 21st, 1976, on Washington, D.C.'s Embassy Row. Next up, as the United States marks National Hispanic Heritage Month, we speak to two historians about a brewing controversy over the creation of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Latino. Back in 30 seconds.
¿Dónde pongo lo hallado? En las calles, los libros, la noche, los rostros en que te he buscado. ¿Dónde pongo lo hallado? En la tierra, en tu nombre, en la Biblia, en el día que al fin te he encontrado.
¿Qué hago ahora? What Do I Do Now? By Sylvia Rodriguez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at a brewing controversy at the Smithsonian Institution over plans to build a National Museum of the American Latino. In 2020, Congress passed funding to create the museum along with an American Women's History Museum. But there's been a deep divide in Washington over how Latinos should be portrayed in the museum. Last year, the museum opened a temporary exhibit inside the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. The exhibition is called Presente, Latino History of the United States. Republican lawmakers and other conservatives within the Latino community have attacked the exhibition, leading the Smithsonian to halt plans for a future exhibition on the Latino civil rights movement of the 1960s. In its place, the Smithsonian is now planning an exhibition on salsa and Latin music. This fight is exploding into public view in the midst of National Hispanic Heritage Month, which runs from September 15th to October 15th. This is Jorge Zamanillo, the founding director of the National Museum of the American Latino, giving a brief tour of the current exhibit in a video posted by the Smithsonian.
Well, Latino history is American history. And to tell that full story and tell a full history, we need to acknowledge our colonial past. So here we feature a portrait of Popeye, the sculpture. He's a Tiwa leader, organized the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. We feature Toypurina, which is a medicine woman that was opposed to colonial rule. So these are important stories to feature and highlight how important they are in shaping our future. And these communities were around for hundreds of years before European colonization. So that's important on how that led to shaping our history.
Lulo and Presente, we further explore how racism and colorism developed during the colonial period. And we have a few examples in Puerto Rico that illustrate this point for visitors. This 1973 poster by Agustin Marin emphasizes that role of Black Puerto Ricans in the abolition of slavery on their island in 1873. We can also find deep historical meaning in Latino music and dance traditions. This outfit belonged to Tata Cepeda, an icon of Puerto Rican bomba music. Bomba is a family of rhythms and dances with African and Caribbean roots that has historically offered Black Puerto Ricans a space for creative resistance and renewal. Bringing it back to today, here's a great photo by Joaquin Medina documenting the Black Lives Matter movement in Puerto Rico. For us at the museum, Latino is a label that brings together racially and regionally diverse communities. Representing both our commonalities and our differences is a core part of our work.
That was Jorge Zamanillo, the founding director of the National Museum of the American Latino. One vocal critic of the museum's exhibition has been the Cuban-born Congress member Mario Díaz-Balart, who threatened in July to block funding for the museum. He serves on the House Committee on Appropriations and later backed down on his threat after he met with Jorge Zamanillo and Lonnie Bunch, the secretary of the overall Smithsonian Institution. After the meeting, the museum changed parts of the exhibit featuring a foam raft used by Cuban refugees to flee the country. The original exhibition text said the refugees were, quote, escaping Cuba's economic crisis. In July, the text was changed to add a reference to Fidel Castro and, quote, Cuba's dictatorship, political repression, and economic crisis, unquote. Some of the first public criticism of the current exhibition came from a group of conservative writers who penned a column in The Hill
Hill last year, claiming the exhibit offered a, quote, unabashedly Marxist portrayal of history, unquote. The controversy comes as the Smithsonian is seeking to raise enough money to build a museum, which will cost an estimated $800 million. The New York Times reports $58 million has been raised so far. We're joined now by two historians who've been hired to develop the now shelved exhibit on the Latino civil rights movement of the 60s for the museum. Felipe Hinojosa is a history professor at Baylor University in Texas. He's also the author of the book Apostles of Change, Latino Radical Politics, Church Occupations, and the Fight to Save the Barrio. Johanna Fernandez is an associate professor of history at City University of New York's Baruch College. She's also the author of The Young Lords, A Radical History of the United States. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Johanna Fernandez, let's begin with you. What has happened? I mean, the idea that this museum was going to be built either across the mall from the Museum of African American History or in the Tidal Basin. But this, your Presente exhibit, has led to this kind of uprising on the right. Can you explain what the current exhibit is, what the one that has been shelved is, for at least for now, that you and Professor Hinojosa have been the creators of?
Presente, well, thank you for covering this evolving crisis. Presente is the current exhibition at the Molina Family Gallery within the American History Museum at the Smithsonian. It's an exhibition in waiting while the actual building of the Latino History Museum goes up in 10 to 12 years. What is important about Presente is that it really outlines the contours of Latino history, which are complicated. One of the points it makes is that the largest Latino population in the United States was integrated after the United States war with Mexico in 1848, which is responsible for giving the United States its contemporary boundaries. Half of the United States was acquired during that war, and the people who were in those Mexican lands remained in the now borders of the United States, and the integration of those people into a hostile America is part of American history. The the Presente exhibition also highlights the acquisition by the United States of Puerto Rico in 1898, and also discusses the ways in which U.S. foreign policy and economic policy has driven people out of Latin America and into the United States. So what's important is that it establishes the question, who are Latinos? How did they get here? And what's their relationship to their communities and to the nation and the world? Unfortunately, conservative Latinos don't want to hear that narrative. They want a narrative that emphasizes Latino military service and business success among Latinos in the United States.
And Professor Felipe Hinojosa, you come from, you work and come from Texas, a state at the forefront of some of the culture wars that we're experiencing today. Could you talk about how you learned of the concern here and what you were told by folks at the Smithsonian about what needed to change or didn't need to change in terms of the work you were doing?
Well, thank you, first off, for having me. Yes, I am from Texas. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley, born and raised in Brownsville, Texas. That has shaped a big part of who I am. It shapes a big part of the work that I do, writing about and teaching on the Latino civil rights movement has been a centerpiece of the work that I do and that I've collaborated with other historians in doing. And I think in joining with this work with the Smithsonian, I think for me, the biggest joy and the biggest thrill was to be able to present these questions that Johanna has just mentioned, the larger and broader questions of who are we and who are we as a community and what is our relationship to the nation were central questions for Latino civil rights activists in the 1960s and 1970s. We worked on this exhibit, on the Latino Youth Movement's exhibit with the Smithsonian for 2 years. We were 65% complete. And the sort of rumblings that started to happen came immediately after the piece that was published in The Hill. I believe it was summer of 2022 when that came out. And there was some concern in terms of the kind of material that we would be presenting. But I think for us, our major concern was just to make sure that we were telling a truthful story, a complex story, and a nuanced story about how Latinos have grappled with their relationship to the United States. The critiques that came to us and what we were told in terms of what could be and could not be included, I think were alarming to us. And when the email came in November of 2022 that this exhibit was going to be paused or canceled, I think it confirmed our fears of the fact that the Smithsonian was not viewing the Latino civil rights movement as a broad enough story, as a story that would raise the kind of funds that this museum needs to open in 10 or 12 years. And I think from the work certainly that we have done and the work that we were engaged in for 2 years, nothing could be further than the truth. What's bigger and what's more, I think, central than young people asking themselves and their communities how they can make this a nation that is better for all.
And Johanna Fernandez, this whole issue of political leaders putting pressure on a museum to basically override the historians that the museum has chosen to develop its exhibitions?
Well, I think we have to look at this conflict in the broader history of the last 10 years. When conservatives have launched a calculated and broad-sweeping campaign to essentially eliminate the teaching of Black American history, Latino history, ethnic studies, women's history, and LGBTQ plus history in the schools. And now what we see is that through this witch hunt and by smearing historians and curators as Marxists, these conservatives are using fear to essentially push through their agenda. And now, again, this has reached a federal museum, and not just any federal museum, but the largest network of museums in the world, which is known as the Smithsonian. In many ways, this sounds and looks like a repeat of the Red Scare or previous moments of repression in the United States.
So, Professor Fernandez, what is your response to them sending you this email saying they're putting your next exhibition on pause? To be clear, Presente is now in that temporary natural American history museum space. And the one you're doing on the civil rights movement is the one that is paused, saying that they want to appeal to a larger audience, especially because they're fundraising. And so they'll shelve the civil rights issue and do instead an exhibition on salsa music and Latin music.
I think we have to say that there is no more integral matter in the United States than the struggle for freedom, democracy, and to redefine the United States as a country for all. That's integral and core to the American imagination. So to say that this issue is a minor one is really to not understand the very essence of American history, upon which the American Revolution and its determination to fight for liberty and the pursuit of happiness is core.
And Professor, Hinojosa, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the in Texas itself, there clearly is a very significant and strong conservative population in the Latino community. So this is some not only is this a national ethnic struggle, there's also a class component to how people view history. What's your sense of the why it is so important to tell the story as you have researched it and looked into it throughout your career versus what some of the political leaders of your state might want?
Well, first of all, I would say a lot of political leaders are often disconnected from the grassroots community. They don't understand what the community is asking for. I've been in the classroom for over 20 years. Students are wanting more of this history, wanting to better understand how Latinos have shaped Texas politics, have shaped the history of the United States, and not just Latino students, by the way. I'm talking students of all backgrounds that are very invested in telling a bigger story of American history and having a broader understanding of it. The other thing is demographic change. The demographics of the state of Texas. Texas is now a Latino majority state. And so to have those demographic changes that have taken place in the last 20 years across this state, I think signal to us a tremendous responsibility to teach this history, to have a better understanding of the contributions of this community. We are not perpetual foreigners. We are not people that are new to this nation. We have contributed for generations to make this country what it is today, and in particular in my home state of Texas. And the idea is not to simply talk about a liberal versus conservative idea of history. The idea here is to tell a story that is complex, that is nuanced, and that gets at this idea of democracy, that gets at how different people from different sections of society have made this country what it is today. And I think in particular, the state of Texas. I mean, there's a reason why Texas history classes fill up the way that they do at universities across my home state of Texas. People love this history. They respect it. They admire it as they should. But we need a bigger telling of it. We need a bigger story, a story that brings in marginalized voices, voices that have been silenced throughout history. And I think our exhibit was one small step to try to do that, not only at the state level, but at the national level.
And could you give perhaps some examples of what you wanted to put forth in the civil rights exhibit, especially in terms of Texas, a history that many Americans perhaps may not be aware of, whether it's the Crystal City uprising in the early 60s or other aspects of Texas Latino history?
Yeah, in particular, we were looking at the ways in which Latinos in the state of Texas and across the Southwest and across the country have not waited for the nation to do something for us. We're not sitting idly by. Historically, what we've done is we've taken matters into our own hands for political participation. You mentioned Crystal City in 1963, gaining a ground to the Crystal City's city council. There was a group of five Mexican Americans that won those city council seats. That was a huge, huge shift, and I think a call to the state of Texas that Mexican Americans were serious about political participation. They went on to form La Raza Unida Party. They ran a candidate for a governor here in the state of Texas. And that's the kind of history that we want to tell, one of agency, one of power, one that gets at how Latinos have not simply waited on, but have acted upon to make this country more democratic and more representative for all.
Professor Hinojosa, we want to thank you for being with us of Baylor University in Texas, and Johanna Fernandez, professor of history at City University of New York, Baruch College. And Juan, thank you so much for your book, Harvest of Empire, Stories of Latinos in America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
Afro. African psych,
pigeon rap,
and anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.